Hey, welcome to Kamloops Alliance. My name is Chris. I'm glad that you're here. Lead pastor of the church, Matthew 27. Get your Bibles, folks. We're continuing our series, Famous Last Words, looking at the seven statements that Jesus said from the cross as he's dying. And obviously, this is leading us into Easter. Before we get there, just three quick things. The first thing is we kind of, sort of, maybe think that in-person gatherings may be allowed again at some point, maybe. So we're kind of deciphering what we're hearing from our provincial health officer, and our team is preparing for in-person gathering. So whenever we get the go-ahead from the government, we will do as much as we can to facilitate that, and then we'll get that out to you as soon as possible. So what I'm saying to you is, we're on it. Number two, last weekend, we had a Holy Spirit weekend with Alpha. Alpha is a great program that just introduces the basic tenets and answers the basic questions to Christianity. And so all of it kind of leads up to this one great moment. Well, all of it is great, but this one moment's important. And last weekend, we had one person in Alpha decide to give their life to Jesus as their leader and forgiver. And so I just give that to you just to remind you that Jesus is alive and he is doing amazing things through our church right now. So that's something to celebrate. So I wanted just to give you that. Finally, I just want to again just cast vision for our great team that we have here at KAC and all of the stuff that we are doing to help you in your spiritual formation. So for instance, if you are an adult, you want to get connected to different people, you want to grow in your faith, we're starting a Rooted program in April. You can sign up for that. Our next generation team, next gen team, Pastor Cody, Pastor Carlene are doing awesome work with students. And so if you are a young adult and you want to get connected to our church, grow in your faith, there are young adult life groups online right now that you can sign up for. Pastor Carlene is doing great work in preparation for Easter. There's going to be a lot there. And every week there's content for you, for your kids. And so engage with it, even, yes, in this strange time. Last one I'd show, and there's lots more, but last one I'd give to you is season three of the podcast. I don't know if there is better content available in the entire world when it comes to answering some of the big questions that you may have of Christianity. And so check that out anywhere you get your podcast. Season three, it's just been awesome. Okay, Matthew chapter 27. Verse 45, your Bibles are open, of course. It says this, "From noon until 3 PM, darkness came over all the land. About 3 PM, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, 'Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani,' which means, 'My God, why have you forsaken me?'" What we're going to do, I'm just going to outline what did he say and what does it mean? What did he say and what does it mean? The first thing we need to notice is all of a sudden I'm speaking English and then there's Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. What does that mean? This should stand out to us. It should be surprising to us what Matthew is doing. See, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani is Aramaic. It would have been the spoken language of the common person and the spoken language of Jesus. The original writers of the New Testament would speak Greek. And so what we have in the original manuscripts is Matthew in Greek, and then all of a sudden it cuts out, it goes to Aramaic, this, and then it goes back into Greek. And what Matthew is doing is he is giving us the very spoken words of Jesus on the cross, the only time in all of his gospel that he is doing this. And so this stands out, I believe, for us as we consider what he is saying and what it means. So that's the first thing we need to notice. So when he says, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani," Matthew also defines it for us, and it means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The first thing that Jesus is saying is a psalm. As he is bleeding out, dying on a cross, he is praying the scriptures. So if you go back to Psalm 22, verse 1, it says, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Psalm 22 is a psalm of lament. It's a psalm of grief where the author is processing his emotions, his feelings of discouragement or desolation, and Jesus on the cross is praying this psalm, a psalm of lament. It goes on. In verse 2, it says, "My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, I find no rest." This lament continues in verse 6, actually all the way to the last 10 verses of the psalm. It says, "But I am a worm," in verse 6, "and not a man, scorned by everyone, despised by the people." And it goes on and on and on. Jesus on the cross is lamenting this moment. My God, why have you forsaken me? It's interesting, in our Christian tradition, which is called evangelicalism, we're kind of known to be the happy, clappy tradition. So I remember like camp songs that I used to sing as a kid. One of them went like this. Forgive me, I will sing a little bit. It goes, Jesus, you are my best friend, and you will always be, and nothing will ever change that. And like, okay, I get the song. I get it. It's kind of cute, but it's just kind of this really surface level song, and everything is up and everything's happy and clappy. And if you're not, well, you don't have enough faith. And if you're not, we give out texts like Romans chapter 8, brother, sister, all things work together for good. That we actually, in our tradition, don't have a lot of space for lament, which is what Jesus is doing here on the cross. We don't have space in our tradition. We also don't have space in our culture, I believe. We have two tensions in our culture. The first one is we do have space for radical authenticity, that this is who I am and this is who I am behind closed doors. But yet at the same time, there's a competing value of being aesthetically pleasing, of being put together, of having the Pinterest life and the Pinterest home and the Pinterest wedding and the Pinterest birthday party. And that those are competing things that we don't really know which ones are allowed in our culture. So we don't have room for lament in our tradition. We don't have room for lament in our culture. And what ends up happening is if we don't have space, or if we don't give people space to lament as Jesus is here on the cross, what ends up happening is we stunt our relationship with God. Somebody said, emotions lead us into reality, and reality is where we find God. And so what I want to do is I'm encouraging us to give space for this, to give space for yourself, for the last year and the losses of this last year. Maybe the sickness and diagnosis of the sickness of your child. Maybe a loved one passed away. Maybe a broken marriage is your reality. Maybe it's your singleness that you just feel so lonely. Maybe it's the cancer diagnosis. And what I believe Jesus is doing is he's providing space for us to bring our emotions, our grief, and our lament to him. And so we're going to have a time at the end of this time together this weekend to provide some space for lament. So what is he saying? The first thing is he's saying a psalm. Back to Matthew 27. The second thing is he says a question. Why me? Why me? Why, God, have you forsaken me? So he's not triumphant. You think about like a character like William Wallace, you know, Mel Gibson in Braveheart. He's a Scottish knight fighting for independence, and there's this amazing scene, and his face is painted, and all of the guys are just barking and howling, and you know, freedom. Jesus, at the end of his life, he asks a question. He says, he cries out in a loud voice. You know, the option is he could say, God is love or freedom. He doesn't. He asks a question. Why me? So if you're checking Christianity out, I think this is really, really important, because sometimes the myth is that, you know, the start of the Christian story was just fabrications of Jesus, and it grew, and then Constantine gave it power, and then it became the official religion, blah, 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 blah. But here's the truth, is that if you were trying to start a religion based on a character of Jesus, this would be absolutely embarrassing to put in an obscene criminal's death, and at the end of his life, he's not rallying the troops. He's asking a question as a defeated Jewish man from Nazareth. You would not include this. Why? Because it would be embarrassing, and yet, here it is. And I believe that gives us faith and trust that this is what actually happened. Why questions are the hardest questions to answer. They're the hardest questions to answer. When you think about when or what or where questions, you can answer those by asking your device. So let me show you. Hey Siri, when do the Vancouver Canucks play next?
The Canucks take on the Oilers on Saturday at 7 p.m.
Easy. It's an easy question to answer. You can go online, you can go ask your device, and you can get the answers to that right away. How questions? We have great methods like science, and science comes in and gives us answers on how does this chemical react with that one. So what, where, and when, and how questions are easy, but why questions are hard. They don't come as easy. Oftentimes we have to get somebody close to us to help us understand the answer or at least a response to why. Counselors, we pay counselors to help us understand the why of why did my dad leave when I was a kid? Or why did my business partner take me for all that I was worth? Why is the coronavirus here? Those questions demand relationship. And oftentimes, we don't have answers for them. I read this week this great statement. It says, if Jesus asked why, let us all be extremely cautious in saying because. If he asked why, let us be cautious in saying, oh, here's the answer. Look, sometimes we don't know, and sometimes we will never know. And so what I want to do is I want to be a part of a community that gives each other space to wonder and to grieve and to not always give answers. So what did Jesus say? He said a psalm, he said a question, and then he said a verb. For all of you English majors out there, we know that sentences hang on verbs. Verbs. And what is the verb in this sentence? My God, why have you forsaken me? That the whole sentence hangs on this word, forsaken. So, what was going on here? When Jesus is saying, why have you forsaken me? What's going on? What we need to do is we kind of need to get our theologian hats on a little bit. We're going to go for a deep dive here. I'm going to try to be gentle, but I'm going to be clear about what is he saying? I'll give you the answer first, and then I'll unpack it. What was going on? At this moment, the wrath of the Father against sin was being poured out on Jesus. When Jesus says, why have you forsaken me? The wrath of God is being poured out because of sin on Jesus Christ. That at this moment, Christ bore the sins of humanity, spiritually separating him from his Father. So from eternity past, Father, Son, and Spirit had been in relationship with each other. There was love and harmony and grace there in that relationship. But because God is holy and majestic and pure, he cannot cohabitate with sin. And so he turns his face from the Son, and the wrath of sin is being poured out on Jesus. He is the one who is forsaken. So that's what he's saying, but I realize we need to unpack these ideas. And so welcome to church, everybody. If you're checking us out, we're going to do a nice, light conversation about wrath and sin and justice. Woohoo! Okay, so here we go. What is wrath? We need to understand wrath. This idea of wrath or the wrath of God is deeply biblical. Deeply biblical, doesn't get as much press as his love, but it is a deeply biblical subject. D.A. Carson says there are over 600 direct or indirect references to the wrath of God in the Old Testament, and Jesus unpacks it in the New. He talks about the cup of God's wrath that he's going to drink on the cross. So this is a deeply biblical subject. What is the wrath of God? Is God's response to sin, his response to evil. Because God is holy, majestic, he is above all things, he is pure in and of his character. Anything that is evil, he cannot cohabitate with. It is against his character to do so. So the theological term of what is happening here is propitiation. And Jesus is appeasing the wrath of God, which is what propitiation means. He is taking the wrath of God in and of himself. And so the theological definition of the wrath of God is his personal divine revulsion to evil and his personal vigorous opposition towards evil. Now, let me just qualify a few things. When we think about wrath, we think about maybe your dad who flew off the handle and took out his belt, or we think about road rage, just a spontaneous outburst of anger. That's not what God is like with his character. He doesn't outburst. It's a steady opposition to evil. The other thing I want to qualify, sometimes when we talk about propitiation, the wrath of God, that there's divine child abuse going on, that the Father is abusing the Son on the cross. But when you hear that, what people fail to understand is the Trinitarian commitment to redemption. That Father, Son, and Spirit have always been planning this moment, and that the Son is willingly going through this moment. It's not that Jesus is unwilling. He is the sacrificial lamb giving of himself. That the Trinity is committed to this. In Reformed theology, what we say is that the covenant of redemption from eternity past, the Father and the Son had agreed on this moment. And so it's not divine child abuse going on, and it is not an outburst of anger. We cannot splice out the character of God. Sometimes we just, oh, he's just loving and he's great. No. He is who he is at all times equally. He doesn't just have happiness one moment, then hate. He is equally all things at all times. And so that's the wrath of God. Well, what is the wrath of God against? It is against sin. It is against sin. I say that word, people are, you know, repel from that word, sin. Oh my goodness. In our therapeutic culture, where we live in a time where everything is for my benefit and I have to feel good, and to talk about sin, I understand, is difficult. But what I would say simply this, I don't want to lose you, is I believe that the word sin is a proper diagnosis to all that we see is wrong. If you don't have a proper diagnosis, you can't actually solve the problem. And I believe sin is a good solution, a good definition of what it is. So what is sin? John Stott says that sin simply is humanity's bid for independence, for autonomy from God, that we don't want God, we can do it on our own. And so we set up life the way that we want to. We believe that we have a better definition of what is good and true and right and beautiful. And so our finances and our parenting and our relationships and our recreation and our sexuality, all defined by me. The problem with that is that it's actually against your created nature as one made in the image of God, loved, made beautiful by him. But there was a moment in humanity where we said, no, thank you. We can do this on our own. And that's what sin is. And it's evil and detestable to a holy, perfect God. And so sometimes we just like, oh, he can just get over it. Like, it's not a big deal. Like, I'm just kind of spending my money this way. No. It's not just a quiet rejection. It's an active hostility to a God who loves you and has paid the price of sin for you. So when we talk about sin, we want to go into scapegoats. Well, I can't be culpable for this. You don't understand. I inherited these genes from my parents. It was my parents' failure. It was my upbringing. It was the government. It was educational, societal environment. And we want to bring in an alibi. We want to say, well, this is why. But the Bible's clear that we all have we are all moral agents in front of God, that there may have been difficult circumstances. There may be predispositions for this, that, and the other thing. But we all have a choice in front of God to love him and dedicate our lives in service of him. So I don't want to dilute your pain. I don't want to discredit what you've been through. But the Bible is clear that we are all morally free agents in front of a holy God. So the Bible will come and say things, something like this. For all have fallen short of the glory of God. For all have sinned and have fallen short of the glory of God, which is so offensive because we as Westerners like to have categories for people. I am a good person. I live in the suburbs. I put my kids in soccer. I spend $5 on lattes. I drive a nice SUV. I'm a good person. I may do this and that, but ultimately I'm a good person. And then I drive downtown and those are the bad people. They are the ones, blah, blah, blah. And we have these nice categories of good and bad and we play this silly comparison game. But the Bible's going to come and surprise us and say there are no categories of good and bad people. There is just one category of people. And that category is needy people. Needy people in front of God. In front of God. And we're convinced of our own moral goodness. We're convinced of our own moral goodness. Even me. So this is a season called Lent in the Christian calendar. And the thing that I've decided to Lent or give up is any music, any noise in my car. So it's been really actually great. Every time I've wanted to listen to the radio or podcast, I'm like, no, silence, I can pray. And I've kind of had this idea of like, Jesus is my companion, right? So this is a holy thing. I'm a pastor. This is all good, right? And so I am driving in a parking lot in a commercial space here in Kamloops. And by the way, there are a few parking lots in Kamloops, in these commercial places like malls and stuff, that are like, whoever designed them, I have questions for, okay? So I'm in one of those, and I'm driving, and it's kind of busy, and there's big trucks, and I'm trying to maneuver all through this, and then there's a lady who has her booster juice, and she's walking very slowly in the middle of where I'm trying to go. Just without a clue, completely unaware of reality and the world around her. So I'm here, and I say out loud, "Lady, grab a brain," all right? And then I'm like, oh boy, Jesus is my companion. And he heard that. And it makes me ask the question, who are you when no one is listening? Who are you when no one is looking? Who are you when you are alone? What are the thoughts that are going through? This poor lady, she just is enjoying her booster juice. And I'm just, lady, grab a brain. I'm just angry at her. And this is us. This is like what is natural to us in our world is to cancel and to hate and to give derision to different people for all these things. And what is it? It is sin. It accurately diagnoses the human condition. So the wrath of God is against sin and evil and all of the decay of our world. So what does sin and wrath demand? It demands justice. It demands justice, that sin demanded justice and judgment. The Bible says that the wages of sin is death. The just payment of sin, the effect of sin is death. And this was a consequence given to Adam and Eve in Genesis 3. And so death had to come. It came through in the Old Testament sacrificial animals. Death is a consequence of sin, and it is just for God to do that. So the question is, who will die for sin? Will it be you or will it be Jesus? See, we all want justice when we are wronged. All of us want justice when we're wronged. I was driving, I live in Westside here in Kamloops, and I was driving on the Westside Speedway, Westside Road, and I was going, you know, I was a good boy, and there was somebody behind me who was like tailgating me like crazy. So I got into the right lane, and this young punk drove past me, blue smoke flying out of his Jetta with an N on the back, and I was like, ugh, you know, you young punk. And so then at the end of Westside Road, as we're getting up to the Halston Connector there, there's a cop, and he's pulled this young punk over, and I drive by him, and I'm like, yes, you deserve it. Justice has been served. We all want justice. Like, all of us want justice. We don't want it for ourselves. We don't want it for us. We want it for everybody else. And this attribute of God is necessary, that he is a God of justice. He does not and cannot turn a blind eye to evil and sin and the entropy of our world. You actually want this type of God. I read an article recently on one of the most popular pornography websites on the internet. I think it was like 3 billion views a month. And there is growing accusations against this website for facilitating child pornography on their website. You think about the Larry Nassar scandal of a few years ago, who has like over 100 charges of sexual assault for young gymnasts before they were groomed by him. You think about the atrocities of Hitler. You think about all these, like, that demands justice. Like, the cry of the human heart is that demands justice. And so listen, on the cross, the justice of God is seen. Because Jesus takes the wrath of God against sin and evil for eternity future on himself. The weight and guilt and heaviness of sin is put on the Son. But his love is also shown that you are worth the price of redemption and reconciliation because of who Jesus is and what he has done. For all have fallen short of the glory of God, that the just payment of sin is death. And yet here, when Jesus says, my God, why have you forsaken me? It is this moment that Jesus is giving himself over to the wrath of God that you and I would go free. That's what he said. Now, what does he mean by all of this? I want to draw some implications for us. The first thing is that Jesus demonstrates real faith by praying a psalm. He demonstrates real faith by praying a psalm. It's easy to be full of faith when the fridge is stocked and the bank account is full. It's different to reach out in real faith when it's difficult, when times are less than ideal, when you are suffering. And Jesus demonstrates here real faith. When he feels the forsakenness of the Father, he still cries out to him. Even in the furnace of suffering and death, Jesus still cries out to the Father. And I think it's an invitation for you and I, in the middle of the fiery furnace that you may be walking through, in the middle of not knowing what the test result is going to be, that it is in these moments, as Jesus is doing to his Father, that we cry out to him. So what I want to encourage you, in the middle of your difficulty and in the middle of your pain, to lament, to bring these things to Jesus. Because here on the cross, he is dying our death. He is submitting himself to the brokenness and suffering and question of the world. And so I think it paves the way for you and I to do the same. So cry out to him today in the middle of whatever you're going through. Secondly, Jesus sympathizes with us by asking a question. As he is fully human, he represents all of the human experience that Jesus can say to you and I know what it's like. That he takes on our abandonment, our questions, our feelings, and our most agonizing experiences on the cross. The author of Hebrews, in Hebrews chapter 4, says, "We have a high priest who is able to sympathize with our weaknesses." To sympathize. That word sympathize is basically a co-suffering. He suffers with us. It's with us in our suffering. And as we listen to Jesus on the cross, say, my God, why have you forsaken me? We see a love that cannot be held back when he sees people in pain. If I could recommend a book to you, it's a book called Gentle and Lowly by Dane Ortlund. I read it last year. It's powerful. Dane Ortlund, in thinking about, reflecting on Jesus' sympathizing with us in our weakness, he says this: "The reason that Jesus is in such close solidarity with us is that the difficult path we are on is not unique to us. He has journeyed it himself. It is not only that Jesus can relieve us from our troubles, like a doctor prescribing medicine. It is also that before any relief comes, he is with us in our troubles." Listen, like a doctor who has endured the same disease. Listen to how powerful that is. It's not that you just come into the doctor's office, the doctor has poor bedside manner, here's a prescription, go get it filled. No, we sit down with the Savior who has endured the same disease, who can look across the room to you and say to you, "I know what it's like to feel abandoned. I know what it is like to be without." And so Jesus, being fully God, identifies with us in this phrase. Oh God, when you get that phone call, when you get that diagnosis to say, "Oh God," he says, "Oh God, where are you?" So Christianity stands unique in the marketplace of ideas in this way, that God has wounds. And in Jesus, he carries the pain of this broken world in his body, and so do we. A body that is broken down, a relationship that is broken down, a business that is broken down. Jesus sympathizes with us. And so Jesus on the cross takes a step towards you and I, living in our pain today. And this, I believe, offers immense hope. This is the only religion, the only ideology in the marketplace of ideas that you can explore where this is true and held so dearly by those who follow Jesus. So that's number two. Thirdly, what does this mean? That Jesus took our place in being forsaken. He was our substitute. That Jesus was cut off of the favor and fellowship of the Father, and the full weight of sin was placed on him. And he was our substitute. That Jesus went to bat for us. If the wages of sin is death, that's what we see on the cross. That the sin that we have, which binds us, that is disgusting, that denigrates our humanity, we see in Jesus that he was pinned on the cross. He was a slave to sin, and he bowed his head to it. Oftentimes, you and I want to get out of things. Oh, I don't want to take that test. Can you take it for me? Oh, I don't want to go through that test or this trial. Can you do it for me? I don't want to suffer like this. Can you come in and do it for me? We want to get out of it. And Jesus enters that place and that desire. And so Jesus voluntarily and knowingly bowed his head under the power and the weight of sin, the thing that you could not solve, the problem that you could not get over, the addiction that keeps you hooked to it, all of these things, you could not save yourself. And so Jesus comes and does it for you. So God demands the penalty and then provides it in giving of his son. And this is the good news. John Stott, in his famous book, The Cross of Christ, says this: the concept of substitution lies at the heart of both sin and salvation. For the essence of sin is man substituting himself for God, our bid for independence. While the essence of salvation is God substituting himself for man. This inspires your worship. Don't you see that Jesus was forsaken so that you could be brought in? He was banished so you could be welcomed in. And all loving relationships involve substitution. All healthy, loving relationship involves substitution. My kids got the flu vaccine this fall because of all the COVID stuff. We didn't want to have sickness in our house. And so my wife took them for their first flu shot. But then the booster shot, I went along just to kind of help out. So imagine, I have three young kids, 7, 5, and 3. And so they all walk into this room in the public health unit, and they're terrified. We promised them Dairy Queen blizzards at the end of it. But they come in, and they're terrified. And they have to watch each other get this shot. So the one goes up, like, you know, poke. It becomes like the house of horrors, basically. And there's so much tears and anxiety and fear. And for me, as a dad who loves my kids, what love demanded was I wanted to take their place. I'll take the shot. I wanted my strength to overcome their weakness. And I wanted to absorb their weakness into my strength. This is what all loving relationships do. And all of the best stories involve substitution. All of the best stories that have captivated your heart, the ones in the movie theaters, the ones that you have read, the ones you hear on the news, captivate your heart. Even something as simple as this, The Lion King. All right, I'm a young parent, so I've had to watch that movie. I mean, I remember it as a kid. But substitution is at the heart of The Lion King, right? Simba, the herd of antelope, and he's getting run over by the antelope. And then what happens? Mufasa, his dad, comes in and he saves his son. And then what happens to him is by saving his son, he actually falls and gets trampled to death by the antelope. It's at the core of The Lion King. It's at the core of any media story that you hear about a blood donor or an organ donor, right? Somebody has a functioning organ and somebody else in their weakness doesn't. And so what love demands is that they go and they're drawn to that need and they give up their strength and they absorb the weakness into themselves. That's it. Maybe even a story that you've heard in the news in 2018, a French police officer traded places with a hostage during a standoff situation. And because he substituted himself for the hostage goes free, and the officer ended up losing his life. Substitution is at the heart of every good story. And listen to me. When Jesus cries out in a loud voice, my God, why have you forsaken me? He took your place, absorbing the wrath of God against evil and sin. And he who was perfect and innocent took your place so that you could go free, that the chains are released and you can go free. This is the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ, unique in the marketplace of ideas. And listen to me, powerful enough to melt the heart of an independent Westerner like you and me. That if we actually got this, it takes your breath away. And I found when we talk of this language, we often, if we don't have a high view of the majesty of God and the ugliness of sin, we hear this story of substitution and wrath, and we just like, oh, that's cool, great. And it's kind of like somebody behind you in line at Tim Hortons says, hey, I'll grab your double-double, I'll grab it. And you're like, hey, that was really kind of you, thank you. And you walk out and it's like, hey, it marginally affects you, but it's not that big of a deal in the long term. But if you have a high view of the majesty and holiness of God and an adequate view of your sin, It's not that Jesus paid for your coffee. Listen to me. He paid your mortgage. And that's just not, oh, hey, cool. That's you would melt at the feet of whoever did that. And in a spiritual sense, Jesus has done this and purchased you a new and transformed life from whatever you're going through today. And so that leads us to communion, this great act of the church where we remind each other and ourselves of the cost of your freedom, the cost of your salvation. So Paul, in this ancient church, leads an ancient church through an ancient meal. And he says this, "For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.' In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is a new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes.'" It's simple bread and simple juice, but they are transformed in that they would nourish our souls. These are the gifts of God for the people of God, and I can't wait to do this in person very, very, very soon. But would you think about the sacrifice of Jesus for you in whatever your life is right now, and would you respond appropriately? So what we're going to do is I'd invite you to take the elements right now and partake of that. We're then going to go into a question. It's just one question we want you to reflect on, maybe as you're taking these elements. We want you to think through, well, what does this mean? What response does this demand of you? Maybe for you, you're checking Christianity out. You've never actually heard this story articulated like this before, and you want to take a step towards Jesus. We have a prayer team that would love to help you, love to minister to you. You can get a hold of me or one of the pastors if you have follow-up questions. Maybe it means you need to realign your life to Jesus, that it's not just something, he's not just someone that you just add to your life on the committee of your life, but somebody that you bow to and say, my life, my very life is given to you in response to what you have done for me. So it demands some type of response. So reflect on that as you go through that question. Then there's going to be a response song. And you probably don't know this song, but we wanted to give you space, especially for those who need to lament, who need to grieve. It's going to be a song that facilitates that for you. So listen and reflect on it. Again, thank you so much for being a part of this. I know it wasn't like super nice and light and fluffy this weekend, but I think it's so meaningful for us to place ourselves at the cross and to consider Jesus again. So I love you. I can't wait to see you in person whenever that is. Thanks for being here. See you next week.